Hello, and a very warm welcome to No Heathen Land, a podcast retelling macabre, intriguing, and just plain weird stories from the past, from God's own country, Yorkshire. In my opinion, Yorkshire is the perfect breeding ground for the most weird and wonderful tales. In Yorkshire, we have the rolling, vast countryside of the dales, dark, tangled woodlands, remote back roads, but also industry, hard labour, a history of staunch religion, farming, tight-knit communities, immigration, a welcoming attitude, intolerance, riots. Much of this documented, a vast amount not. It's the stories in between the newspaper headlines that I really want to get into. Through my experience working in local history, it's really quite surprising how many odd tales you come across simply by looking into one single person's family history, for example. A newspaper article, a diary entry, a theatre playbill, a photograph. I'm very lucky to have made friendships and connections with interesting and enthusiastic people right here in Yorkshire. Each episode will feature one of them as a very special guest, where we'll delve into some of the stories we've come across that have fascinated, baffled, and sometimes unnerved us. Because of the subject nature of this podcast, some stories will not be suitable for everyone. Approach with caution.
Hello. Welcome to episode 3 of No Heathen Land. Once again, thank you so much for listening to previous episodes if you have. If you haven't, then maybe do. Or don't. You do you. Also, once again, I am sorry for the delay in getting this episode out. I haven't set myself a schedule, but I have put this weird pressure on myself to get stuff done in some made up idea of how a podcast should be released. But never mind. It's cool. I'll just pretend it's intentional and casual. But anyone that knows me will know that that's just not my vibe. But here we are. So, episode 3. With my friend and another ex-manager. I've had many, as you'll see, that are now friends of mine. Oops. She's now Senior Local Studies and Research Librarian in Leeds. And probably one of the coolest and fun parents I've ever met. This episode is with Louise Birch. So Louise puts her whole self into everything she researches and always keeps a good sense of humour to everything she does, and I think that really comes across in this story. Today's story is slightly different in tone to the previous episodes and indeed the ones to come as well. This is definitely more of a deep dive into a local history topic, a very classic Victorian tale of industry. This is the story of the construction of the Bramhope Tunnel. If you have a preconception of the story of a tunnel being boring, let me tell you, you're wrong. This tale has skullduggery, scandal, floods, a human hamster wheel of sorts, child labour, all the local history classics. So stay tuned until the end if you want to hear more about what's to come and how to find out more about the sources used for this episode. Go forth and enjoy No Heathen Land, episode 3. Hi, just jumping back on for a second to apologise for a little bit of phone interference that occurs a couple of times during this episode. I'm really sorry if it's distracting. I just wanted to make people aware that I was aware. On with episode 3.
No Heathen Land. Thank you so much for being my guest. So Louise is, what is your job title?
Senior
now?
Librarian, yeah. Local Studies and Research.
Yeah, and that's in Leeds. So we are covering Yorkshire for this podcast, but I think a lot of it is going to be in Leeds just because that's where I'm based and that's where I know the people. So how did we meet, Louise?
I remember meeting you at library headquarters, possibly 10 years ago, and you were in charge of our brand new social media accounts, and I think you were stood there going, I'm not doing it all, you all have to send me content. And I just remember, like, wow, this girl's got bright pink hair. She looks awesome.
Did I have pink hair?
Oh, you had some kind of colourful hair. I don't think I've ever known you to not represent colour in some way.
Hmm. That's so interesting, because that was not what I remember. That was all I remembered.
What's your
memory? That was actually about 8 years ago, I think, ish. 7 or 8 years ago. And I was the social media and community engagement librarian, which was new and shiny.
I had just come back from maternity leave, so eight years, yes.
Yeah, I think I might have met you a little bit before. Oh, I think I thought that I'd met you after that. But of course, because I met literally everyone doing that job, because I was like, we need the social media to be good, send me stuff. And then people just sent me garbage.
Yeah.
not you, obviously.
No, not me. I was a development librarian for Central at that time. I would hopefully have had some stuff to send you. And I was setting up the blog. So I must have sent you something about that.
So I remember the first time I remember actually meeting you was on a mobile library, but it was parked outside Central Library.
Yes.
And you were pregnant, probably with Lily.
Lily, yeah.
Yeah, so that must have been, how old is Lily?
She will be 7 on Sunday.
Oh my God, okay, yeah.
So,
wow,
7.5 years ago.
Oh my goodness. So
that's how I date everything now, by at what stage of life were my offspring when I met you.
That's what I remember. And I remember you having a tattoo on your arm.
Yeah.
And I also remember that you had cool Converse on with flames on.
Yeah, I wore those into the ground.
I don't know why I remember that.
Because they were awesome.
Yeah, because they were awesome.
They literally fell off my feet.
Yeah, but that's all I remember. But that's so funny that you remember doing that, because I just had to go around and boss everyone around about social media, and then no one listened anyway. And then the job disappeared. but then I came to work with you.
Yes, you came out to work in local and family history. Yeah. I came back from my second maternity leave and was given local and family history because I had some prior experience working in there, and I spent the next year and a half suffering major imposter syndrome, going, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I do feel like I know a bit more about what I'm doing now.
You definitely do. I also got given the job. I didn't. Yeah, it was because mine had disappeared essentially at the same time, and then I was given a choice of a couple of different departments, and I was like, oh, I'll choose that one, and it was their best decision.
I know, we are an awesome department.
We're really lucky. I got Louise on because I knew that she'd have some good stories, and you've got a couple of really good ones, and maybe later on in the series we'll have you back to talk about the other thing that I know that you are, I would say, a pretty expert in.
Okay.
You talked about them a lot. You researched them a lot. But this is probably a little bit different to most of the other episodes, because this is not spooky and it's not particularly macabre or weird. It's just a really interesting story, but there is sort of a disaster-y element to it, isn't there? So do you want to tell us what you're talking about today?
So I'm going to tell you the story of a tunnel. It's a Victorian railway tunnel. It is the Bramhope Tunnel, and it is the story of conquering the ridge, because as we all know, Yorkshire is not a flat county, and if you want to build a road or a railway line at some point, you're going to hit a hill, and you either have to choose to go over it, through it, or under it.
It's one of those things where I think this comes up especially in local history, where someone will send you an inquiry or you'll find something and you're like, why would anyone want to know about this? And then as soon as you start looking into it, you're like, wow, this is amazing. Like any kind of infrastructure or transport, especially transport, things like that, people are just obsessed with it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We can just get going. And if you don't mind, I'll interject and ask questions, because I have a few from the notes that you sent me. I have a few questions.
Okay.
So.
So the reason it kind of becomes this, the moments of macabre, I suppose, you get from it is that we've always thought about 23 men died during the building of this tunnel. However, the amazing people at Otley Historical Museum Society, they've done an awful lot more research, and they know they've got that number up nearer the late 30s, 40s now. Quite a lot more people died than we originally thought. So I'll give you a few quick facts about it. So the Bramhope Tunnel makes up part of the Leeds Thirsk Railway line. It's 39 miles long in total, and that includes various viaducts and the tunnel. The tunnel itself is 2.13 miles long. It's 25 feet wide and about 25 feet high. So the story of the tunnel begins in the 1930s with a man named George Hudson. Now, Hudson was a Tory politician and he was the Lord Mayor of York, and he acquired the moniker of the Railway King due to his enormous and somewhat dubious influence over the national railways. So the rails, many of the rails that you and I ride today, down to this guy, that's where they are. Now, in 1833, a number of York businessmen, including Hudson, founded the York Railway Committee. They wanted to get Leeds joined to York so that York could benefit from cheaper coal and industrialisation in the same way that Leeds had. However, other groups were also making plans for Northern Railway lines, including one that would link Leeds with Newcastle, but it would bypass York. Now, Hudson was not standing for this. So in 1835, the committee became the York and North Midland Railway, and 2 years later, they began construction on a new line under station at York. So the line was connected to a junction on the existing Leeds-Selby line, finally linking York directly with London in 1839. But here comes the skullduggery part. On November 9th, 1940, the York and National Midland Railway leased the Leeds-Selby line for £17,000. Immediately, they shut it down, which meant that all Northern Railway traffic had to go through Hudson's hometown of York, which was his devious plan all along.
That was crazy. That like one guy can just be like, "Yeah, we're not doing that."
But if you look at a map, a railway map now, if you want to go north, you've got to go through York. The number of times, if I'm going to Scotland or I'm going to Newcastle, you go through York all the time. It's still there, that little hub that he built.
So at £17,000, what do you think that would be in today's money? Like,
I have no idea.
A lot.
It's going to be so much. I mean, we're going back...
It's the 1840s.
Yeah, we're going back to the 1840s. So all the figures that I'll kind of throw at you. I think at some point later on, I look at the whole cost and what that would cost now. But yeah, £17,000, they must have been pretty confident with this plan of theirs. Yeah. However, this angered many of the Leeds manufacturers and merchants, the names that we know, like the Marshalls and the Gotts. I mean, they and their forebearers had not built the air navigation, the Leeds-Liverpool Canal, put in a load of turnpike roads and the Leeds-Selby Railway for all this to be scuppered. They'd done all that so that they could move their products efficiently, and Hudson's actions kind of ruined that a bit. So they were really not happy. So in response to this, they sought to create a railway line to the north. This would link Leeds with the linen towns of Knaresborough and Ripon and onto the ports of Hartlepool and Stockton.
So for someone that didn't know who Marshall and Gott was...
They were the big mill owners. They were making the cottons and the fabrics that Leeds is really, really well known for. Yeah. They were, you know, the Richard Bransons and the Bezos of their day, where Leeds are concerned. You name it, they built it. Yeah. So, yeah. Now, there were three possible routes proposed for this. The first was discounted due to the gradient being just too high. The second, because it would disrupt valued fox hunting land in Ecop. Yeah. Now, the third one was the one that was taken on, but it did involve going through lots of hills and valleys of the Yorkshire countryside. Now, in 1844, a prospectus stated that these would be overcome with viaducts over the Aire, the Wharf, the Nidd and the Crimple Beck, and that a 1¾-mile tunnel would be used to conquer the Wharfdale Ridge. So a capital of £800,000 was estimated to cover the cost of the line from Leeds to Thirsk, and this was raised through sales of £50 shares. Mm. Yeah, it cost a lot more. Just a little spoiler there, but this is not one of those projects that comes in on time and on budget.
We'll try. If we haven't got like a full costing thing, I will convert it for the episode so that we can see what that was. Because £800,000 in the 1840s.
We're talking, it's got to be millions today,
multi-million pound.
Yeah. So who were the Leeds and Thirsk Railway Company? We had the company secretary, who was author and government reformer Samuel Smiles. The engineering team was led by Thomas Granger, a Scottish civil engineer who also built the Workley Roundhouse on the Leeds Inner Ring Road. He was assisted by John Bourne as resident engineer and William Walker as section engineer. And William Cubitt, a renowned civil engineer, acted as advisor. The contract for the line went to Mr. James Bray of the Iron and Brass Foundry on Black Bull Street, Leeds. And Bray also operated the Pool Bank Quarries, which would provide over 50,000 tonnes of stone to the viaduct archways.
Wow.
Bray also helped build various railway and branch lines, as well as the first Leeds waterworks, the Crown Point Bridge and the Leeds New Dock. So he knew what he was doing. That's a lot of names I mentioned, but I'm going to give you a recap at the end and we'll find out where some of them then later popped up.
Yeah, and as I said before, we're putting links to all sorts of things in the show notes and on the website for the podcast. So if anyone wants to know anything more, there'll be loads of links if people want to know like a bit more of context for the, like, the background of people.
So, why a tunnel? So a tunnel is proposed when the cost of creating a cutting through digging and shoring up exceeds the estimated cost of a tunnel. For people who don't have a huge knowledge of railway lines, a cutting is basically where they get a big hill and they just cut a straight line through it, so there's no tunnel over it. It's when you're on a train and there's big banked bits at the sides and you can't see the countryside at all. So that's cutting. The ridge was too high. It would have cost way too much to do that. Mm-hmm. Now, the original planned length of the tunnel was 3,344 yards, but that length was extended to 3,520 yards, at the wish of local landowner William Rhodes of Bramhope Hall, because he didn't want it to open out onto his countryside. He wanted it to go under. And then that was extended again to 3,743 yards to cope with water. Water is going to be massive in the story of this building.
Yeah.
Of these building works.
I can imagine.
So once your plans are agreed, you've kind of got to actually build the thing. But in the case of the tunnel, it's not just digging, it's as much building. The tunnel cuts through hard sandstone, shale and clay. There are several major faults in the rock near the middle, as well as hard white stone near the south entrance that proved expensive to blast. So first of all, you build two siting towers, and they're erected to keep the line true. One of these is still there in the field at the corner of Moor Road and Moreland Road. It's 40 foot high, and it's still got its interior stone staircase, and each of them cost about £140. So once you've got your siting tunnels, you then create 15 shafts between the two. And the idea is you will dig down the shafts and then dig out from either side, and eventually everything will join up, creating one continuous tunnel. This did prove too slow, so another 5 shafts were sunk for a total of 20. 10 feet in diameter and brick lined. 4 of these shafts were made permanent at 40 foot wide, lined in 2 foot 6 inch thick blocking course work, and they remain today as ventilation shafts. So if you drive out towards Otley, you can still see one of them, a huge one on the side of the road.
Oh wow.
Anyone who wants to know about blocking course brickwork, I suggest using your preferred internet browser and asking the question, because that could be a whole nother hour.
Mm.
Okay.
People love bricks.
They do, absolutely. I learnt this through watching a couple of YouTube films on how to build a tunnel, just so I could give this talk.
There is a brick museum, isn't there? I'm sure they've got an Instagram.
There is, yeah.
And it's pretty cool. If I can find it, I'll link it.
Absolutely. So we're going back to the 1800s here. There's no big machinery. All these shafts are dug using picks and shovels through loose ground and explosives to get through the rock. Typically, the time frame for this kind of work is 6 feet per week. So if you know anybody who's 6 foot tall, it would take a week to dig their length. And when complete, they would see teams of men lowered down in huge brass buckets who would then work by candlelight.
Oh, that sounds awful.
Very different today. So Brewery Lane part of the tunnel is 290 feet below the surface, and the shafts near there could have taken up to 40 weeks to dig just the shafts. Okay. Now, you were paid £1.50 per week to shovel 20 tonnes of rock and earth for a 12-hour shift. Once the bucket had taken the men down, it would then be used to remove the spoils, and this was all operated by winchmen and powered by horses. The horses would work 6 to 8 hour shifts, with many of them worked to death.
Oh, that's so horrible.
Yeah. Rods would be attached to the side of the shaft to make sure you went to the right depth for your specific location, and plumb lines, notched boards, cords, and an awful lot of geometry were used to make sure you stayed on track. Because with multiple teams working from multiple points, it's vitally important that everyone keeps on the same line and at the same depth, because otherwise your tunnel, one part of your tunnel is going to meet another part of the tunnel and they are not going to fit together.
And these, the shafts were 10 feet diameter.
Yes.
It's not that, that's not very wide.
No, there is, we do have some photos that, that show these buckets that would have been lowered down, so I can give you those to link to. There was also ran the risk of, if the winch broke, this bucket would then plummet the 40 foot down the shaft. So I mentioned earlier that water played a huge part in this tunnel. In fact, it nearly scuppered it from being built completely. In September 1846, the York Herald ran an article updating the public on how well the building was going. But it ended with this quote, "The flow of water is more copious than was anticipated." Now, this statement was not only true, but continued to be true throughout the entire build and beyond. Working conditions were constantly wet. They used metal sheets to try and divert the water coming through the tunnel, while at the same time water was being taken from the Bramhope well opposite St Giles Church for construction and living, so making the bricks, cooking food, everything like that. Unfortunately, the excessive demands produced so much that they destroyed the well at Bramley and new water courses had to be dug.
Where was the water coming from? Like, where was it flowing from?
It's all natural springs within the wall, the ridge.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you're essentially, you're battling against nature. It's not a case of, well, once we've drained this, it's done. It was constant. It just never stopped. Mm. And it came through the natural gathering ground of the ridge. It flowed down into the wharf at Pool Beck, to the Aire at Addle and Horsforth Becks. But this water already had a use. So by this point, you've got mills existing all along these becks and rivers that were using that water to power industry to get the job done. Now, not only is Bramhope Tunnel diverting water, but it's then overrunning water and you're ruining those industries completely. So a lot of farmers had a lot of arguments against it as well because it was destroying their natural irrigation. And there were court cases and claims for compensation that had to be met and litigation took place to agree it. Now, if you buy a house in Bramhope today, certain houses, they still have buried within the deeds rights to water and all the history of all this litigation that took place at this time. So it went on for many, many years. Now, the water coming into the workings for the ridge caused huge costly delays with construction. Each time a shaft flooded, it had to be pumped out. But the original pumps bought in for the job just proved too weak and work was held up for months at a time. In April 1846, plant equipment included a six horsepower engine, a 4-horsepower engine, a 10-horsepower engine, and 5 25-horsepower engines. In June 1846, a report shows that they were pumping 338 gallons per minute for 2 months, day and night, without being able to overcome the spring.
Wow. Now, what?
I know, it's insane, isn't it? When you think about some parts of the world where water is an absolute luxury rather than just human right.
Flowing into your tunnel that you build in.
Yeah. And
oh
then,
my goodness.
Oh, it's just horrific. Now, they eventually brought in a 40-horsepower engine. This was at a cost of £850. Now, this increased their pumping capacity to 4,194 gallons per minute in January 1847. Now, in total, it's estimated through looking at engineers' reports that 1,563,480,000 gallons of water were pumped out of these shaft workings. That figure is just too high to comprehend. So to give you an idea, in terms of UK Olympic-sized swimming pools, that's 2,843, or it is enough water to fill the Serpentine Lake in Hyde Park over 18 times.
So when they were pumping out the water, sorry if this sounds really daft, I have no idea. When they were pumping out the water, what were they doing with it?
I imagine they were just trying to take it back down
just
to the river.
Take it back so it flowed back in again.
Yeah, but I mean, they wouldn't have had hoses or pipes or stuff like that. So,
oh my gosh.
I could not find anything in the engineers' reports that actually said, well, we got all the water out and this is what we did with it. I don't know. Maybe they just let it carry on running down the ridge.
Yeah. Maybe if you're an engineer, that's really obvious, but that's not obvious to me. Okay.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So once they dealt with the water, tunnelling began with the laying of the foundation stone at shaft number one in July 1846. So once your shaft is finished, you then lower a team of miners down and they will start going in one direction out along the line that you've created. maybe 8 feet wide and 8 feet high, and they would use wooden beams and trees to shore everything up. In this way, a complete mini version of the tunnel could be created to join everything up, and you knew you were following the right line. Once connected up, it made communicating so much easier, and you no longer have the risk of creating an underground human-sized rabbit warren. So once the miners had gone a certain amount of distance one way, they would then switch to the other side of the shaft and start digging out that way, at which point labourers would go into the bit they'd already dug, and they would start building the body of the tunnel, all the bricks. Temporary railway lines would also be laid at this point because it made it much easier to remove the spoils. Okay, so on Bramhope Tunnel, there was a total of 22 teams working at any one time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, when I say the miners would work for a bit and then swap to the other side, at best they'd maybe work about 12 feet past where they got to, and this was called a length. It varied from tunnel to tunnel, but it completely depended on what material you were working through. So shale, shorter lengths, because there was the risk of it collapsing in. You would have to get the builders in to shore it up before you could go too far. Rock meant you could make much longer ones because there was less chance of it collapsing in on you. Once the side they dug out would be filled with labourers and bricklayers who would build the tunnel lining using massive quantities of mortar and on average 30,000 bricks per length. Now, mortar is cement, and when you think about the amount of water that goes into making cement, that's what they were taking out of the wells that they ran dry, despite the fact that the tunnel was being filled with water at a different, you know, but I think that was too dirty to use. I think you need clean water for your cement to set properly.
Yeah.
Now, it's not written down anywhere, but if the tunnel is 3,743 yards, this is me going to attempt some maths now.
I'm all for it.
That's 11,229 feet. Now, divided by lengths of 12 feet makes 935.75 lengths. At 30,000 bricks per length, I personally estimate that the Bramhope Tunnel took approximately 28,072,500 bricks.
That's a lot of bricks.
I know. Not bad for someone who got a C in GCSE maths.
Yeah, but yeah. That's better than me. That's all I'm saying about that.
Yeah. So they would build from the bottom of the wall up and over their own heads. And the last part involved something that the 18th century loved, a bit of child labour. So a boy would be pushed into the space above the bricks and then he would pack the void. Now, you can't have any voids because any voids gives the opportunity for land above to slip in and you can cause cavings. Okay, so the floor was laid with flat bedded stone with a minimum size of 7 foot squares. The walls were 8 inch thick blocking coursework, and it was all bound with Roman cement, backed by puddled clay and by rubble, and faced with concentric ringed brickwork.
I wonder how they recruited these boys to go and fill the voids, just like, here boy, just walking past you, like, do you want to get in this tunnel? Yeah. We'll give you a pound.
Well, very possibly. I mean, whole families would go and yeah. live on site, whole families. So I imagine it was the builder's children, because if you're going to send any child up into a small cramped space and just yell at them and make sure they know what they're doing, you're probably going to use your own, aren't you? Because yeah. you then get their wages, don't you?
That's very true.
So, yeah. Now, each of the tunnels received very different treatments. The south end was very plain, while the Gothic north portal was given this beautiful castellated finish. It is now a Grade 2 listed building and it contained rooms. The stories behind this, like the local landowner William Rhodes wished to use the rooms as a belvedere. That is a fancy word for a room with a view.
Is it? I never yeah. knew that.
Yeah. So if you've got a room, a good view out of any room in your house, you can call that your belvedere.
My belvedere. Oh, my attic is an absolute belvedere.
Well, Sally will be sat later in her belvedere editing this very podcast.
Mm-hmm. It's very hot and humid up in the belvedere at the moment.
At this time of year it will be, yeah. Now, there is a head carved onto the front, which has again been suggested that it was carved to resemble this Mr. Rhodes, the landowner's face. Now, we're not sure what the original plan was, but the rooms were eventually used by railway staff, and now they're just boarded up and no longer used by anyone.
Have you seen it in person?
No, I haven't. I was invited to go and take part in filming a documentary about it, but it was right in the middle of lockdown. I did not feel this was a good use for essential workerdom. which,
yeah,
you know,
probably not.
Also, I had two children at home. They did offer to say, well, maybe they could learn something about it. I was like, it's February. I'm not standing out in February in the snow with two small children talking about railway tunnel. But no, I've seen lots of pictures, but yeah. It is a plan one day to go there. Now, there's a very good reason why portals, the entrances to railway tunnels, were made such grand and imposing structures. And it very much comes down to the same reason why Victorians built banks that were so impressive and elaborate. With banks, they felt that the structure gave the impression of affluence and assurance to the users. You're not going to just, if you put your money in a little shack built of wood that looks like it could be knocked down tomorrow, it doesn't really fill you with hope, whereas the big stone structures do. Same thing with the tunnel portals. You know, people weren't used to being in tunnels for this amount of length of time. Trains didn't race through them as fast as they do today. So you wanted to make people not fearful going into them, that they were going to come out the other end. The whole tunnel was finally joined up in November 1848, and the first train went through on May 31st, and that was the Leeds Thirsk Railway officials pulled by Bray's locomotive Stevenson.
So the first train went through 31st of May 1849.
Yes.
Is that right?
1849, yeah. So the whole thing was joined up 1848, but again, they've got to finish it off, they've got to lay the tracks. It did take them another sort of 6 months to get it train worthy. So yeah. So as the tunnel was completed, all but four of the 20 working shafts were capped. They were filled in from the top and backfilled from the bottom. And the idea was the landowners did not want giant, unsightly holes in their land. In theory, a record of the filled in shafts existed, should have been kept. But there have been cases in the UK where records weren't kept, and that has led to incredibly dangerous cave-ins and sinkholes with houses swallowed up.
Oh,
we do have a record of where, we can see it on our OS maps, we know where all of these tunnels were in the Leeds one. So the tunnel officially opened a week later than expected, so only 1 week's delay, not bad.
That's not bad.
Yeah, on July 9th, 1849, and the public were able to travel through from the 10th. And at the time of opening, Bramhope Tunnel was the third longest railway tunnel in the country.
Do you know which of the two were?
I don't. I probably did when I first wrote this, but I did not write it down. Because I don't care for those tunnels. I'm talking about my own homegrown Leeds tunnel.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, that's fine.
That's what's all I'm bothered about too. Unless they were in Yorkshire, and then we'll find out.
Do you want to hear about the scandal of the first day?
Yes, please.
So there were three trains left on the 9th of July, each of them carrying shareholders, directors and other VIPs. The first train left at 11:45. It comprised of 17 first, second and third class carriages.
17
carriages. Oh, not of each, just 17 carriages, 17, a mix of first,
oh, 17,
second and third.
Okay, I was like, sorry. What, 17 of each class?
So the Bank Temperance Band played lively music through the journey. There was a brief stop at Carbridge Station, which is now Horsforth, after 11 minutes, mostly to wave at the crowd there who had amassed, and then they set off again for the tunnel. It took 7.5 minutes to travel through the tunnel. It did arrive at its destination of Thirsk at 3 or 4 minutes past 2 p.m., so about 2.5 hours to get from Leeds to Thirsk. Today it takes about 43 minutes and you are through the tunnel so incredibly fast. Mm-hmm. It's almost a blink and you'll miss it. When they arrived, the passengers were treated to luncheon in the carriage shed with a bar serving ale, porter and spirituous liquor. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the first train load were an incredibly greedy bunch, so they literally ate the best of it. The second had a moderate lunch and the third literally only received scraps. So if you were on that third train, well, you definitely didn't do as good as the first.
Oh, so, that seems very unfair, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Maybe needs a better catering organisation.
Absolutely. Or someone just, you know, stopping people from downing all the drink when they first get there.
Yeah, that's true.
It's like when you get to a wedding and everyone makes a mad dash for the bar. Well, if they've, you know, if it's like a limited free bar, mm-hmm. everyone gets there first to try and get a few down them.
Yeah.
So now the tunnel is double track, but there is only one train at a time allowed, and there is telegraphic communications between the north and south entrances relaying that information. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you want to get to the part about the accidents and death?
That's what we're here for.
That's what we're here for. Let's get to the...
Yeah. Although, like, these kind of, like, disaster things are so scary, especially with things like tunnels. It's, like, claustrophobia and people getting
and the
crushed,
dark.
I assume.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dark as well. So, yes, proceed.
Okay.
Time for spooks.
So, as well as all the incessant water problems, they had foul air, they had gunpowder fumes and dangers of roof collapse, and working by lantern light made for incredibly unpleasant working conditions. So there is this idea of the industrial age not caring about health and safety, especially for the working man. This is an era of children being sent up chimneys and under milling machines. So it's not hard to imagine a scenario where masters and railway contractors just didn't care so long as the work got done. Now, actually, it would have been really, really hard to minimise the dangers of what this work involved. They were in tight spaces, they were working by lamplight, there were the risks of flooding, they were working with explosives. There wasn't really that much they could do to manage the risk. Railway tunnels are still being built today, and I imagine right this minute under the City of London, something is being dug. However, the majority of the dangerous jobs are now automated and taken on by machines. Well, they didn't exist back then. We had men, we had pickaxes, we had dynamite and candles. So it really is a bit of a recipe for disaster. Now, the official Bramhope Tunnel Memorial lists 24 men who died. However, we know this number would be a lot higher, as no record was actually kept for accidents or sickness until 1847, which is a couple of years into building. Local folk memory suggests there may have been a very serious accident early on in the tunnel construction, because a couple of years in, when they were compelled to start keeping records, that's when we find out that an increase of up to £100 was made in the form of a grant to Leeds General Infirmary and a spring cart provided to carry casualties and patients the 6 to 7 miles to the hospital and further grant to the Beckett Street House of Recovery.
Oh.
So that happens about 2 years in.
Right.
That money starts flowing to organisations to help. So yeah, you've got to wonder what happened in the early days. Also, those early days would have been when the blasting was taking place, when the use of dynamite was in use, and you've got to wonder just how many lives were lost, how many injuries happened that did not make it to the record books. And I spoke earlier about Otley Museum, and they have been doing amazing work at tracking down every single record, finding all the names, and they have increased that list so it actually is a lot more accurate of the number of people who lost their lives. Okay, so you've also got water flooding into the works, causing around 4% of the deaths. But by far, the biggest killer of the Navy workforce was pneumonia, which took about 10% of lives.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, obviously, I was going to ask earlier on about the weather, because, you know, they finished it in November, and then they've got the 6 months to finish it off. But, like, in November, December, January, February, March even, we get snow, we get ice.
And this tunnel was going 24 hours a day. Well, I can't find any records of, you know, we stopped. And they didn't stop for water.
And you're always wet. Oh my goodness. Okay.
So the majority of the deaths would not have actually taken place on the tunnel underground. They would have taken place in the bothies and the small shanty town. Well, a huge shanty town that built up around the tunnel that people lived. Also, one of the most horrific ones, sudden flooding would have trapped men below ground. There was no way they'd have been able to get out of there. And we know that water was a huge issue with Bramhope. There's also cases where the spoils bucket, so that bucket that the men would travel down in and was then used to take all the waste material out. There's instances of that bucket and lift snapping while full of waste material and this crashing down onto the men below. So huge amount, different ways of injuries. So also a lot of the workforce would have been extremely poor and far from home. So it's believed that some of these would have been buried in unmarked graves and that the names of the men on the Otley Monument tend to be the names of local men who lived local or were from other areas of Leeds. So yeah, we think maybe the monument was there more to honour the local lads, and if you'd come from far and wide, and people did, then you were very probably just buried in an unmarked grave somewhere and not even, barely even reported. So newspaper reports and obituaries tell us of the names of the men who died. who weren't included on the monument. So, for instance, there's a William Willoughby who was buried in Addle on New Year's Day in 1847. He was a 28-year-old from Benfield, Berkshire. We know that he died as an employee of the company, almost certainly in the southern tunnel working. James Myers of Yeadon came to his death in the tunnel on April 14th, 1848. He had the rare dignity of a well-carved tombstone in Chapel Hill burial ground with the inscription, "What dangers do surround poor miners everywhere." Now, James is particularly a sad tale because he was 22 years old when he died, and it was three weeks after the death of his three-year-old daughter, who died of an unspecified illness.
That's so sad.
Yes. We've also got an unknown labourer who was seriously injured at the number 10 shaft on a Monday evening shift. No death was recorded, but falling stone crushed his head and broke his thigh in three places. So you imagine a case like that, he would have been loaded onto this spring cart, which I think is literally just a horse and cart, and taken to Leeds General Infirmary by horse and cart. That must have taken a huge amount of time to be laid there in that amount of pain. And deaths weren't restricted to just those working directly on the tunnel. All job sites carry dangers, and on February 13th, April 1847, a 13-year-old boy named Holgate, employed by the masons at Castley, was severely injured by a wagon, and he died the next day. On May 7th, 1847, we have another unknown labourer with a water cart at Arthington, who, backing it into the river, fell into deep water, and both he and the horse were drowned. Now, we've got at least five instances there over 2 years. Now, it just seems highly unlikely that the number is as low as it was reported.
Yeah.
And that there are so many more that, you know, we'll, despite the huge amount of research that's been done, we will never actually find out.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, it's said that statistically you would find one death for every mile of track completed. And at 39 miles long, I think the Leeds Thirst Railway, with its tunnel and viaduct, has actually taken well more than its fair share. So, yeah, mining tunnels is dangerous work, but some deaths could have easily been avoided. Now, this isn't about the Bramhope Tunnel, but it is a story, just to illustrate the point, about the building of the Keimer Tunnel in Wales, where miner Richard Parsons, part of the gang driving the tunnel, was making up charges immediately above his explosives, in defiance of orders and in disregard of warnings and reprimands. So those orders, warnings and reprimands, that was health and safety of its day. You know, he knew he shouldn't have been doing it. He'd been told not to do it. He was doing it. Inches away in the cabinet behind him were 150 pounds of dynamite.
Oh my God.
A single candle illuminated the scene, and when it fell over, there was only one possible outcome. Parsons, a 13-year-old boy, John Clements were reduced to atoms. 11 others were also lost. So it's not necessarily the health and safety we think of today, but it did exist. Navvies did know what they were doing, as well as the engineers, and best practice was in existence. But as we know, sometimes it just takes that one fool who's like, I'll do it my own way, this way's quicker, I've never had an accident before, it'll be fine. And it's not.
Yep.
So once the tunnel was completed, the contractor, James Bray, erected the Bramhope Tunnel Memorial in Otley Churchyard. No names or dates are mentioned on it, but it does take the form of the elaborate castellated north portal of the tunnel. It's highly unlikely that any of the men who died over the four-year period were actually buried underneath this memorial. The memorial was built after the tunnel was completed, and I can't imagine that as people were dying, they were putting them all in the same spot going, we'll shove a memorial there at the end. So, yeah. So do you want to know how many people it takes to build a railway tunnel of this magnitude?
I absolutely do.
Yeah. So the workforce. A huge workforce was created to construct this tunnel. Now, in 1845, the village of Bramhope had a population of about 350 people. So try to imagine the impact of 2,300 navvies, many with their families also, moving into the area and living on the site for the duration of the works. This is how we built things back then. Transient workforces moving along mile by mile as something was built. The field in which the remaining sighting tower still exists, opposite Bramhope Cemetery, was both home and job site for the workforce. 200 temporary wooden bothies huts were constructed in the field for the men and their families to live in. Now we say temporary wooden structures. These slept 17 people. Oh. So, you know, they weren't small. As the tunnel digging was done in 12-hour shifts, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you had many cases of men sleeping what's known as box and cock style. So as one man rolled out of his bed to begin his shift, another man rolled into it at the end of his. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they factored in doing laundry and all that, or if just for the number of years this tunnel was being built, nothing ever got washed. But yeah.
Delightful.
Those beds and those huts would have smelled pretty strong. Mm. So alongside these residential huts, there were offices, there were stonemason yards, there was a joiner's shops, explosive stores, stables, coal stores, sawmills and workshops for the brickworks. So those 30 million bricks we talked about, they weren't brought in, they were made on site. Wow. Records show some of the enormous workforce included 188 quarrymen, 102 stonemasons, 732 tunnelmen, 738 labourers, 18 carpenters, as well as around 400 horses. So another 100 bothies could be found along the line as it moved more north, and a large encampment was set up at Casterly by the bend in the river, which, if I'm right, is now a very popular wild swimming spot.
Mm. Mm. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Doing this.
Yeah. So some of the ancestors of today's traveller communities would have been part of this workforce. Others would have come from Ireland as poor refugees fleeing the Hungry Years, so they would have come to work on the railways. A lot of farm labourers came from the Yorkshire Dales, from the North East England, from East Anglia and the Fenlands, as well as from Scotland. So this wasn't just the people of Bramhope going, I'll get a job down the local building works. People came from all over the place for this. The local churches at Poole and Bramhope were filled on Sundays, despite the scandalous actions of the railway, who ran two shifts each Sunday, even through the hours of worship, at a time when non-essential train services didn't even run on a Sunday. So this was shocking stuff.
You really wanted to get that done.
Yeah. But they weren't completely godless places, these camps. The Leeds Town Mission had a man on site, and for 4 years, the company made an annual contribution of £100 to the mission. Some railways felt responsible for the satisfying the spiritual needs of the labourers and helping them to live a settled life. 600 Bible tracts per week were distributed. Bibles sold for 10 pence and New Testaments for 4 pence. A famous Navi missionary was Elizabeth Garnett. She was the daughter of the vicar of Otley. She would have been about 10 years old when the Bramhope Tunnel opened, and she described the Navi settlements as patrolled by policemen with cutlasses and native children cajoled to sleep with threats of being taken by a Navi. Now, remember, she was 10 years old at the time, but she did go on to have an amazing life advocating for Navis, for these workforces that were just seen as, you know, fleeting resources to get stuff built and move on.
Yeah.
So the Leeds and Thirsk Railway report books show that the missionaries' efforts to convert the hard swearing, drinking and gambling workmen to a Christian way of life. He distributed tracts and Bibles, organised regular religious services and cottage meetings, and regularly visited the men at work. So he was very active, was the mission there, in looking after the souls of the workforce. But then he went a step too far, Sally. He suggested that the ale and porter that was sold regularly around the huts must be stopped. Now, I don't know if it was his advocacy that turned the fields dry, or if the company felt that less alcohol would improve productivity, but this decision resulted in disaster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go on.
I mean, you've seen what happens when you tell librarians they can't go for a drink after a hard day at work. Imagine you'd been tunnelling and building for 12 hours a day. June 1846 saw a fight break out at Westco Hill Cutting. Joseph Midgley, the railroad inspector, had to call in reinforcements to subdue 300 drunken navvies mangled together in a field of unmown hay. Now, I don't know if there's a film called The Quiet Man with John Wayne set in Ireland, and it's up there when they talk about the top 10 best fight scenes ever, because it's literally just at one point the entire village just laying into each other in a field, and that's the image I have in my head. All these burly, hardworking men just knocking the heck out of each other because they're bored and they want a beer. It's not like they could even say, oh, it was a drunken fight. It was dry. They weren't, I mean, they were described as drunken navvies, but how could they have been drunk when they turned the booze off?
Wow, so, that's a good story. I'm going to look up that fight scene.
Yeah,
I don't think I've seen that film.
It's a great fight scene.
I will look at it when I get home. Yeah.
It's not an incredibly politically correct movie for the treatment of women, but it's a great fight scene, you know. It's great. So Inspector Midgley's reports are incredibly illuminating, and he noticed that the Masons, who were mostly local men, were quiet and well-behaved, but difficulties occurred with those who lived in these overcrowded huts. Midgley spent a huge amount of time on site. He was in and out of the workers' huts and cottages, as they were known, and he knew them, they knew him. He wrote a report in 1847 that tells us a lot about the effects of these temporary shanty towns on the children of the workforce, because these workers didn't just go and work away from home and then go back often. They took the whole family. The whole family went on the road. Now, on other railway sites, children of navvies ran wild. So Midgley made the suggestion that we had to manage this situation. He listed the number of children within who could attend school as 221. However, the village school opened on Eastgate in 1790 already had 40 children attending, and it only had 10 vacancies. This is before the 1870 Elementary Education Act came into force, so there was no legal requirement for your children to be at school. But nevertheless, they were definitely in the way. Midgley estimated that for an expenditure of £20, another 40 spaces could be created. Well, the company obviously decided this was a great idea because they gave a grant of £110 to the school. So, yeah, you can't imagine it being a huge incentive to get children into education back then, especially when you were using them to like finish off bits of tunnel and shoving them in cramped spaces. But, you know, they just wanted them out of the way. So the local residents must have been ecstatic when this railway packed up and left. There were no more fields full of bothies, no packed out churches and schools, no rough navvies wandering the village, and no longer were the roads full of slow moving carts moving materials up and down the line. The shafts were filled in, and once the land lost the signs of its temporary occupation, the only indications would have been the Spoil Hill sites, which soon grassed over. And with the train running through an underground tunnel and no station at Bramhope, it must have been strange indeed for Bramhope to return to this normal rural life. I mean, they didn't even have a station. They could barely even use this train that had taken up years of their lives. So I'm going to do, finally, all those names we've mentioned throughout, or where are they now or then?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Obviously, we know where they are now. They're all long gone, but then. So, do you remember George Hudson, the guy who decided where all our train lines pretty much go in this country?
Yes.
The one with the sneaky skullduggery that tried to get Leeds cut out and made York the centre?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hudson died in bankruptcy, living in France in exile, where he went to escape prison. He deeply regretted inheriting the £30,000 from his uncle, as he saw it that was the catalyst that got him into the railways, which he felt became his downfall.
How can you regret an inheritance?
Yeah. It's like, I love the way he's like, oh, if I'd not got that inheritance, I wouldn't have got into the railways. It's not that he was a dodgy dealer who paid dividends from the capital pot and not the earnings pot.
It's because someone else gave him the money.
Yeah, it's all his fault. It's like, it's not that you were given the money, it's how you chose to use it. So,
okay.
Yeah, that was the end of Hudson. So Samuel Smiles, who was the company secretary, went on to write his 1859 masterpiece, Self-Help, promoting thrift and arguing against materialism with a laissez-faire government. He claimed to be poverty to be the result of wastefulness and irresponsible habits, which is a bit ridiculous, really, because if you're living in poverty, you have nothing to be wasteful with.
Exactly.
But that's how this great man saw it, you know.
Yeah, which is unfortunately often the way in the... Well,
yeah.
I mean, still, but certainly in the... In the
1800s. He did go on to become the great-great-grandfather of adventurer Bear Grylls as well.
So, no way! Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, okay.
There you go. William Cubitt, who is the advising engineer, invented the penal treadwheel, where prisoners would be punished through walking on what is essentially a hamster wheel. Imagine a giant hamster wheel, put a load of prisoners on it. That's the punishment.
These people are terrible.
Yeah, this, well, there's a dark side to engineering, Sally. Now, in some cases, it's been recorded that they would walk up to 17,000 steps a day, which is not too bad if you're on holiday and you're sightseeing, but I'm pretty sure...
And a hamster wheel.
Yeah, and these, I don't think these were situated in, like, Belvederes or anything. It was, you were just facing that rotating wheel. They were even banned in 1902 as a form of prison punishment. But the wheel was adapted into what I like to think of as a modern form of torture punishment, the treadmill.
Yeah, exactly. That is a modern form of punishment.
Yeah, when you were running on a treadmill at the gym or watching someone else, which is more accurate in my case, think of William Cubitt, the advising engineer for this tunnel.
It's just a form of torture.
Yeah, absolutely.
And continues to be.
Yeah.
Wow.
The contractor, James Bray, who's one of the more local men, so he tried to leave this project so many times due to spiralling costs, because obviously he was like covering the costs of the materials, and then you claim it back, but if the person you're claiming it back from doesn't have it, then there's issues. So he tried to find a partner to help cover the costs. He even served notice to terminate his contract in 1847. However, he was still there at completion. And he ultimately he didn't do too badly out of it. So in the years it took to build the tunnel, Bray started out living with his family in Hunslet, then moved to Headingley. From Headingley they moved to Bramhope, and from Bramhope to the Moor Park Estate in Harrogate, a country gentleman's estate with a mansion he rebuilt for £8,000 in an Elizabethan style.
Bargain.
Yeah, so, you know, he didn't do too badly, though he probably went grey over and over again. Yeah. Elizabeth Garnett, the 10-year-old daughter of the local vicar. You've got to wonder if it was the Bramhope Tunnel navvies who inspired her lifelong mission for the improvement of navvy sites. She wrote books to raise funds for the navvy mission. She campaigned for support, writing hundreds of letters to people of influence. She opened numerous Sunday schools. But despite being considered by many to be the force behind this mission, she was not credited with it, and instead credit was given to Reverend Lewis Moole Evans, and he was recognised as the leader of the movement. So,
surprise,
there you go.
Surprise.
Yeah.
Yeah, another person that we know nothing about, another woman that we know nothing about.
Who did a huge amount and was not recognised for it. It's infuriating.
Her legacy is now in this.
It is. So I do mention her every chance I get in relation to this tunnel.
Yeah.
Because, yes, she was not about getting the tunnel done. She was about improving the lives and the conditions. Mm. It would appear between her and Midgley, who got all the children into schools, they're the kind of people that you want involved in something like this.
Yeah.
So let's talk cash, cold, hard cash. The proposed cost of the Leeds and Thirsk Tunnel was £800,000. The final cost of the line to Thirsk was £1,800,000. Yes, they went over budget by £1 million on this train line. The Bramhope section cost over £500,000. So nearly a quarter of the entire line. So the whole line was 39 miles. The Bramhope Tunnel was about 2. So yeah. That costs a lot of money to dynamite through rock. So cost per mile, you're looking at, let's see, £35,000, which isn't bad. The Manchester to Leeds line cost £59,000 per mile, and the Dundee-Aberystwyth line cost £8,000. So I imagine that one's over a much flatter terrain, less viaducts and tunnels.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So shortly after the line was completed, the company name was changed from the Leeds and Thirsk Company to the Leeds Northern Railway, which sounds a bit more familiar with what we know today. The tunnel had been in use for 5 years when a section fell in 1854, so it only took 5 years for it to start falling apart. It was discovered by the next train to pass through, which crashed into the rubble, breaking the couplings of the fifth and sixth carriages, which meant the last five carriages and the guard van began to descend the hill at such great speed, only stopping at Arthington Station by the quick thinking of the injured guard who managed to apply the brakes. Unfortunately, a third class carriage had also come loose and came flying down the incline, crashing into the stationary carriages before the passengers had been able to get off. Amazingly, nobody was killed in this, but there were many, many serious injuries. A roof gap 11 feet long and 15 feet across was found with stone and cement cracked in all directions. The reporter declared that this was not a false shaft nor water, but a faulty workmanship. It took 3 months to reconstruct just this portion of the tunnel. Now, trains have, even today, frequently been cancelled or delayed in recent years because we still suffer the effects of flooding. Water comes piling down off the ridge and straight into the line. And it still happens. They've got photographs on Leodis that show it happening during some cases of very heavy rainfall in Leeds. Water runs incredibly fast into the tunnel, and a 1960s train suffered derailment from a 3-ton icicle hanging down from the track.
A 3-ton icicle?
3-ton icicle.
Whoa.
In 1963, a gale brought down the railway telegraph wires, and so they rerouted them through the tunnel instead, where they were safer. So major repair work was done in 2003 and 2006, with the Victorian drainage culvert replaced. The track was lowered to allow for larger passenger and freight trains. This cost $10 million just to do this. The 16 closed air shafts were deteriorating and also needed to be recapped. So it's a good job we did keep a map of where we had them all. But it is still this amazing feat of engineering, and one that played a hugely large part in the industrial successes of Leeds and a city, and a train tunnel we are still using to this day. But it did cost a lot of lives. So yeah.
That's really interesting. Thank you so much. Okay. So yeah, thank you. That was very, very interesting, and definitely stuff that I didn't know at all. Yeah. And I think people will be coming to the podcast for all sorts of different things, and that's probably quite an unexpected one.
It's probably a lot less gruesome than some of the other ones that you were talking about.
I don't know.
Especially
don't
that
know.
First one that, with Ross.
Well, yeah.
Do you want to know why this talk exists and why I know an awful lot about tunnels?
Yes, I do. I would love to know. I was also going to ask you... So the first two guests that I had on the podcast, so I had Ross and I had lovely Ross and lovely Josh. They are both not from Yorkshire. Can you believe it? The first two people I had on a podcast around Yorkshire stories.
What were you thinking, Sally?
I know, but you are. So you are
born
the first
and bred
legitimate guest. So I just wondered if that fed into you being sort of passionate about finding out things about your local area.
Well, I've always
More interested.
Yeah, I've always loved stories, and I've always loved sort of the folklore and the stuff like that that comes up and through it. And it is an absolutely wonderful part of this job that I get to just learn this stuff, you know, just as an everyday work thing. I live up near sort of Meanwood, and we cross through Carmanna Fields quite often, and there's this big stone structure that's been there since the Civil War era, and then there's this weird mound where I took the kids blackberrying. It was only earlier today I was looking at some pictures on Leodis and discovered that this mound is supposed to be where they buried a load of Civil War soldiers. So
wow,
it's cool things like that. I mean, you know, now I feel a bit bad for eating grave blackberries, but they were delicious.
Well,
and the Civil War was a really long time ago.
Yeah, I'm sure they're not contaminated by the Civil War.
But it's really nice that you see something random in a field, or you spot something, you wonder, why is that there? And the great thing about this job is knowing where to look. But what's great is with the Bramhope Tunnel, especially, is that I've travelled to and from Otley so many times as a kid in the car. We'd visit friends there. And I can remember seeing the sighting tower. I can remember seeing the massive, it's still existing shaft. And it just never occurring to me what that was until I actually started to research this topic. And I was like, oh, I know this place. I know what I'm looking for. I know these sites. And like we go wild swimming down near the Arthington Viaduct. And, you know, I see the trains going over the top, knowing that they're either coming from the tunnel or heading towards it. And it's lovely being able to root your childhood in all these stories that do affect you or don't affect you, I don't know, but it's really nice.
I find it really fascinating that it's you finding out these stories can like put you back in that time and you can imagine it really clearly, like the amount of detail that's in your research. I can see it really clearly. I hope I'm sure other people feel the same as well. It's really nice,
because it was never really my intention to research Victorian train tunnels. We'd been asked to do an exhibition for Workers' Memorial Day, and so we based it around instances in history where lives have been lost through health and safety issues, that kind of thing, in the workplace. And I think for this exhibition I'd written a paragraph on the Bramhope Tunnel, and then someone looked at this exhibition and asked me if I could do a talk on an aspect of a dangerous work environment. I said, yeah, of course I can, thinking he'll choose this one or this one or this one, the ones I know something about. And he came back and he went, that tunnel, can you do that? I was like, oh no, everything I know about that tunnel I could write on the back of my hand.
Yeah, and then you just go further and further into
you
it.
You do,
and, it just comes
and you realise that these amazing stories, like, you know, Bramhope had 350 people, and then this sudden influx of over 2,000 navvies plus families living in these temporary huts. And if you drive out there now, it's still very much fields, and it would be rammed. I mean, I should really look up what the population of Bramhope is now. Mm. I wonder if it ever actually got up to that 2,500 mark again.
I'll pop it in the end. I'll have a look and I'll pop it in the end, and we'll know.
But yes, I am now an expert on one Yorkshire railway tunnel. I know nothing about any other railway tunnels. But yeah,
oh, we had a bit of paper avalanche then.
Happens all the time in the library, don't tell anyone.
So just to lighten the mood, even though I enjoyed that story, there was lots of horrible bits, but that was, I think it was quite upbeat.
Men being crushed to death in dark, dank, wet, smelly tunnels.
Yeah. So to lighten the mood, I've just been asking my guests, what have you been watching, listening to, reading? What have you been up to, Louise?
Over the last few years, I've been working through a list. I think it's a list the BBC did, 100 books you should read before you die.
Mm-hmm.
As a librarian, I thought I'd have an amazing score on this. It was abysmal. So I'm working my way through them. And interestingly, the book I read is not too far from this time frame. And it's The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Oh.
And I mean, I'm not a murder mystery reader. I'm not a thriller reader. And I just thought, you know what? I'll get through it. We'll see. I've seen the TV shows, the American version and the British version, and they're amazing. But they do seem to have long-running threads through them, storylines. And I thought, it's going to be like that, and I'm really going to have to focus and not miss things. And I was so surprised that each story is like just a 20-page short story.
Yeah, they're quite fun.
Yeah, and I couldn't put them down. It'd be like... Yeah. You know, one of the kids would be like, oh, are we having dinner yet, Mum? And I'm like, hang on, I need to find out who did the murder. And 10 minutes later, I'd put the book down. They'd go, who did it? I was like, it was the horse.
Like, yeah, that's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, some of them you can even follow them. Others, you're like, you get to like page 19 and all of a sudden Sherlock Holmes turns up and he's like, okay, so I did this, this, this and this. And you're like, oh, I missed all of that, but thanks for the recap. But yeah, they were great. I would definitely
recommend
them.
They're quite easy to read as well, I think, the books.
Yeah.
I think the British TV version that Sherlock took it in a different direction.
Absolutely, yeah, very different. But now I really, really enjoyed it. And now I'm a bit like... And then I was a bit disappointed, and then I realised there's loads more. So I'll have to do a few more off my 100 books to read list, and then I can cycle back and have another little outing with Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
Great fun. So yes, that's what I've been reading at the moment. So yeah, and it was great.
Okay, so we'll leave it there. So thank you so much for being a guest.
Thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for inviting me. I mean, when else do I get the chance to... talk about Victorian Railway Tunnel.
Hey, you made it to the end again. You're really on a roll with this, like, well done you. Thank you so much again to my guest Louise Birch for this episode. If you would like to follow Louise on social media, she is at LVBirch on Twitter, where she shares all things local and family history and local research as part of the Local and Family History Library and Research Library in Leeds. So just a little snippet about the next episode, because man, I'm excited. The next episode is about a very particular cemetery in Leeds and traditions around death and mourning and superstitions. I'm really excited to share it with you. Yeah, this is exactly what I kind of thought I would be doing when I started this podcast. And I can't wait to share the next episode with you. It should be coming out soon. As usual, if you want to know about the sources for this episode, you can go to the Acast page, which should be linked within the app that you're using to listen to this podcast right now, or you can follow me on Twitter at NoHeathenLand. I really hope to see you there. Ask me questions. Let's chat. I want to hear your spooky stories. I want to hear your weird Yorkshire tales. Hit me up. So thanks again for listening. Thank you to Luke for editing help. And thank you to you for listening and for sticking with me and for the interest in this podcast. Like, I've had a bit of an overwhelming amount of love for putting myself out there, I guess, and following, you know, a sort of personal passion, if you will, for the weird and wonderful. So thank you. And I really hope to make this more of a regular, consistent thing. Let's see how we get on. So thanks again. I will hopefully see you next time. Bye-bye.